Stability of hidden variables theories, de Broglie versus Bohm. Is the focus all right? People can see? Okay, good. So, sketch of the talk. I'm going to start with some background ideas. The view that I have that quantum theory is not a fundamental theory, but is a theory of a particular kind of state of statistical equilibrium. I'm then going to talk about two possible instantiations of this view. There's de Broglie's theory, de Broglie's hidden variable theory, if you like, versus Bohm's version, which is subtly, well, not subtly, it is different, it is different. And I'm going to talk about a sense in which Bohm's version is unstable, and I claim actually untenable. These two versions of what's often called collectively de Broglie-Bohm theory are often seen as just equivalent, and do you prefer one or the other? It's a matter of taste. I think actually there's a very strong physical reason for saying that Bohm's version is actually physically untenable. And then I'd like to talk about stability as a criterion for hidden variables theories generally. So here is a one slide summary, if you like, of my view, of how I see quantum mechanics. The quantum mechanics is not a fundamental theory. We are stuck in a certain kind of physical state, a certain kind of statistical equilibrium that is characterized by the Born rule, where probabilities are related to the modulus squared of the wave function. And when you are in this state, there is the physics is local. You cannot signal faster than light. It is also uncertain, the uncertainty principle. There are limits to what you can measure simultaneously and so on. But the claim is that actually none of this is fundamental, that fundamentally, there is a non-local deterministic theory where probabilities could be, in principle, arbitrary, and that we happen to be stuck in this state because there is a tendency for non-Born rule. So here's the Born rule. Non-Born rule states tend to relax a little bit like roughly analogous to thermal relaxation, though different. And you could think of it as being a bit like saying, you know, in the 19th century, some people were concerned about the classical thermodynamic heat death of the universe, that the stars would eventually burn out, all temperatures would equalize, and we would end up in a state of what's called classical thermodynamic heat death, in which it's impossible to turn heat into work, and nothing much happens. My claim is that something analogous to that actually happened, but at the level of hidden variables, and this is where we are. Now, why would anyone, so this goes back to some work I did in the early 90s, why would anyone believe that? What makes me think that this is true? And I'd like to emphasize, I always do, that I don't think that this picture is particularly tied to the de Broglie-Bohm theory. I think it's just a general picture. You know, whatever hidden variables theory is true, I think something like this something like this picture will emerge. So, what got me thinking about this is thinking about quantum non-locality. So, there is strong evidence that quantum theory is non-local. You have an entangled state. By indirect reasoning, which I won't go into, Bell deduced that with some assumptions, it looks as if changing the setting of a measurement here can instantaneously affect the outcome of a measurement over there. And yet, you can't actually use any of this for non-local signaling. You can't. I can't use entanglement to send a signal faster than light. There are just correlations that seem stronger than they should be, or that they would be if the world was local. Now, question that struck me is, well, why not? If you take this seriously, if the world is really fundamentally non-local, why can't I use that non-locality for signaling? You know, despite Bell's theorem, the statistics are local. To me, it seemed like a kind of conspiracy, as if there's something It's as if there's something going on behind the scenes. There is non-local effects, but you can't actually control them. There's something that violates the standard laws of physics, but you can't get your hands on it and control it. Why not? Why should these spooky connections be hidden? You can deduce they're there indirectly, but you can't really use them. Why? So the answer that I've been advocating for a long time is that we cannot send signals faster than light, and you can't beat the uncertainty principle, not because they're laws of nature, but because we're stuck in a particular physical state, a particular kind of statistical equilibrium, in which it happens to be that these constraints are true. In that particular state, you can't send signals faster than light, you can't beat the uncertainty principle. And if you want an analogy, you might think of, again, going back to the analogy with the classical thermodynamic heat death, if all temperatures are equal, I can't convert heat into work. Why not? Well, it's not a law of physics. In general, you can convert heat into work, but if you're in a state where everything is at the same temperature, then there is this extra constraint that's a characteristic of that, of the state you're in, not of the fundamental laws. Why are we stuck in equilibrium? Well, everything that we see, all the atoms we can do experiments with, have a long and violent astrophysical history that traces back to the Big Bang. There's been plenty of time for things to reach the kind of statistical equilibrium that I'll talk more about. It's always seemed natural to me to assume that this relaxation process here took place in the early universe, and if that's the case, potentially these ideas can be tested using inflationary cosmology. I'll be talking about that tomorrow in the colloquium. I've been focusing quite a lot on that the last few years, so I have some results to show. All right, let me talk a little bit more about this idea of conspiracy. There's a conspiracy in the basic laws of physics. The initial conspiracy that got me started on this was non-locality. Why can't we use it to send a signal? Since then, it seems to me that the fine-tuning problems have increased. The evidence for this view, to my mind, has increased over time. So this, the idea that, well, there's local statistics despite Bell's theorem. So Wood and Speckens in 2015, I think their work in a sense corroborates this point that if you have a non-local hidden variables theory, but you can't actually use it to send signals, then that is conspiratorial. They've looked at it from the point of view of, what is it, causal discovery algorithms, I think is the thing, or something. So there's a paper. This paper in 2002 was a general argument in any deterministic hidden variables theory, pointing out that there's a special state in which you get locality, but if you depart from that state, then you're going to actually have practical non-local signaling. Non-contextuality, this is, to my mind, this is actually the same kind of thing, but a bit more general. Non-locality is really a form of contextuality at a distance. The outcome here depends on what I simultaneously measure over here. It's particularly striking because these things are separated, but contextuality says, well, if I have, you know, two kinds of measurements that I can do at the same time, that the outcome for one measurement can depend on what other measurement I'm performing simultaneously. And again, there's the question, well, hidden variables theory has to be contextual, but statistics, if I marginalize, if I just look at, you know, one observable and I just look at its marginal statistics, the statistics are non-contextual. So it's the same thing. Why, if contextuality is fundamental, why do we always see non-contextuality at the statistical level? To my mind, again, it's telling you that we're looking at the physics of a special kind of equilibrium state and not a fundamental physics. There's also something to do with additive expectations. Maybe I won't go into this, it won't take too much time, but those who familiar with von Neumann's old argument against hidden variables. Basically, if I consider a single spin, the possibility of measuring the spin in different directions, the spin operator in this direction is 1 over root 2, the spin operator this way and that way. And I can take expectation values. The expectation values for these three different spin measurements are linearly additive. But if you look at the actual values of spins for single outcomes, the spin along this way, this direction, or that direction, it can only be plus or minus one in units of h bar over two. Say it's a spin half system. And those values cannot satisfy that kind of relation. Plus or minus one is not going to equal one over root two, plus or minus one, plus or minus one, that kind of thing. So again, I have a paper about that in 2004 saying, well, it's peculiar that this additive expectations arises for an equilibrium distribution of hidden variables, whereas on the fundamental level, it fails. So why? You get these extra properties. Finally, I found this very interesting, the Pusey-Barrett-Rudolph theorem 2012, under some reasonable assumptions, shows that in essence that the quantum state must be a physical property of a single system. It's not just a property of an ensemble and yet the completeness of the density matrix tells you, well, look, I can have different statistical mixtures of different quantum states that give you the same density matrix, and there's no experiment that can distinguish them at the statistical level. They're completely equivalent. So again, there's this thing, hang on a second, you can deduce by indirect reasoning that there are these physical things, there is this physical quantum state, there's this little property of an individual system. And yet, I can mix these I can have different mixtures of these real things and not be able to distinguish between them. Why? It seems to me, again, another kind of conspiracy in the laws of physics that, what have I done? So this is the kind of picture that I'd like to paint of quantum physicists. You're stuck in this equilibrium region, and you're looking, you say, why is the world non-local? Why do we see locality when apparently there's all these non-local stuff going on? Non-contextual statistic, additive expectation, row completeness. You know, there are these physical states, but if you mix them in different ways, you can't distinguish between the different mixtures. Why? My view is that outside of all this, the true non-equilibrium physics, there are physical quantum states. There is non-locality. There are real. You do something here, it has an instantaneous effect on something far away. These are real effects that we just cannot control, and so on. Let me just briefly say something, because I'm going to be talking a lot about the theory of de Broglie and Bohm. I want to get across the point that a lot of what I've said can be discussed in the context of any deterministic hidden variables theory. What is a deterministic hidden variables theory? Well, let's say you're given some apparatus settings M. In other words, there's an experiment that's been specified. It says that the outcomes, here are the outcomes of the measurements, the outcomes omega, that there is a mapping from given some initial hidden parameters. So here's your set of hidden variables. Given the hidden variables at the time of preparation, given a specification of the experiment, there is a mapping that will tell you what the outcome of the experiment is, and it's deterministic. The outcome might be the measurement of a spin, it might be whatever. Now, what happens if you look at this over an ensemble? If you consider an ensemble of such experiments, there will be, in general, a distribution of the hidden variables omega, and the expectation value of the outcome will just be an average of these values averaged over the distribution. Now, in order for a hidden, and that is general, and this distribution could be anything. And I'd like to draw a distinction here, because something that I don't know why this is very hard to get across, but it always seemed to me so obvious, that in any deterministic theory, there's a clear conceptual distinction between the law that takes you from initial to final state, if you like, the equation of motion. There's a distinction between that, this is a law, and this is, the actual values of the initial parameters are initial conditions. They are empirical, they are contingent. this, in a particular run of an experiment, if the hidden variable happened to be here, it didn't have to be here. It could have started somewhere else. This idea of contingency, okay? It's like, you know, Newton's law. I take a ball and I throw it. There's an initial position and a velocity. Then there's a law of motion that tells you how it moves. But the actual initial position velocity could have been different. They're not fixed by laws. So the actual values of the hidden parameters and their distribution is in principle arbitrary. So this expectation value could be anything. For this such a...
Aren't those two different things? One thing to say that the position and velocity of the ball is arbitrary, another thing to say that it could have been anything. You don't know offhand that the distribution function of those possible positions and velocities isn't fixed, do you?
Okay, so could have been anything is perhaps not quite right.
Could have been anything. Could have been anything within some set.
Okay, fair enough. It could have been fair enough. You know, maybe there's a boundary or there's some other restriction. Fair enough. So maybe anything is a bit over the top. Fair enough. But all right, fair enough. So perhaps it would have to be restricted to within some range for whatever conditions that one might be considering. Okay, but now, for a hidden variable theory to be successful, for it to reproduce quantum mechanics, there has to exist a particular distribution of the hidden parameters such that when you perform this average, you get the Born rule, you get the expectation value that quantum theory predicts. So quantum theory says that, well, there's some density operator multiplied by a Hermitian operator representing this observable. I take the trace, that gives me the expectation value. There has to exist such a distribution. Now, the point is, it's a very elementary point I'm making, that if there's a particular distribution that does that, in general, an arbitrary distribution is going to be, these expectation values are going to be different. So general distributions of hidden variables violate the Born rule. So here is a kind of picture, if you like, again, an equilibrium distribution of hidden variables that corresponds to quantum theory will give you the Born rule, whereas for more general distributions of hidden variables, the Born rule is violated. And you can show, as I've mentioned, that if you are in this region out of here, in a general deterministic hidden variables theory, if I have an entangled state, you could actually signal faster than light. The marginal distribution over an ensemble, the marginal distribution here will depend instantaneously on what measurement you make here, and so on. So let's distinguish between the general theory and what you might call the conspiracy theory that is restricted to equilibrium. And my view has been for a long time now that quantum mechanics is a conspiracy theory in this sense. All right, so here we are. So this bag, so that's, you know, the background. And why are we stuck in this state? Well, the claim is that if you begin outside of that state, then with some reasonable assumptions, given what we know about the history of our universe, you will relax into this state explaining what we see. Sorry, yes.
If you're outside of this equilibrium, would you still get the same classical limit of the laws of physics?
That's a very nice question. All right, so it's slightly tricky. I'd say, generally speaking, no. One problem with this is that to define the classical limit is very tricky. There are different ways of approaching it. So, for example, if you took the classical limit to mean a situation where, all of the statistical distributions are very narrow, and you're basically just seeing, if you like, the centroid of a narrow distribution, then it's not really going to matter whether you're in equilibrium or out of equilibrium. If the non-equilibrium distribution is very highly peaked, then you wouldn't really notice anything. But in principle, I can give a simple example, for instance, in de Broglie-Bohm theory. If I had a Gaussian packet, let's say it's a narrow Gaussian that is moving along and it's following an approximately classical trajectory. If inside that Gaussian you didn't have the usual Sy-squared distribution, well, you're not really going to notice. On the other hand, if you were so far away, if you were so far away from equilibrium that the particle was way out in the tail, the velocity of the particle would deviate hugely from Newton's law. It wouldn't move uniformly in a straight line. So I guess the answer that what I would say is if you're in an extreme non-equilibrium, then you could completely violate the classical limit. If you're in a kind of equilibrium that is non-equilibrium, that is concentrated, whose support is in the same region as the usual distribution, and the distribution is very narrow, then you're probably not going to see a difference. Sorry, it's a bit of a long-winded answer, but the classical limit is tricky, I think, on all interpretations. Okay, so let me go forward. All right, so I'd like to move on now with some... We'll look at two particular models, if you like, two particular hidden variables theories. The first, due to de Broglie, goes back to the 1927 Solvay conference. Here is de Broglie, where, contrary to a still widespread misunderstanding, three different theories of quantum mechanics were extensively discussed and no consensus was reached. One of the theories, I've discussed this in a book that I co-authored, one of the theories is due to de Broglie, who in the 1920s, contrary to, I mean, most even historians are not really aware of what de Broglie was actually doing. De Broglie developed a new non-Newtonian form of dynamics. You know, he's remembered just for this relationship between wavelength and momentum, but that was just a byproduct, if you like, of what he was doing. What was his new form of dynamics? So here it is. For a many-body low-energy system of particles, spinless particles, so I've got the many-body Schrödinger equation, you decompose it into an amplitude and a phase. This is de Broglie's law of motion. It says that mass times velocity is equal to the gradient of the phase. It's not mass times acceleration is force, that's Newton's law. De Broglie gave arguments for why we'd have to abandon Newton's laws. I could go into that, but maybe I'll encourage you to have a look at my book if you like. It's a different form of dynamics based on velocities, and this generalizes to, you know, any system with a configuration, with a wave function in configuration space. This could be a field, could be a scalar field on a curved space-time. It could be, you know, it's not just restricted to a low-energy many-body system. But the point about this is that this is a deterministic theory of a single system. Here's the initial configuration of the many-body system. It's moving orthogonal. Its momentum is orthogonal to the these are the wave crests. These are lines of constant phase in configuration space. The law of motion makes the point move orthogonal to these surfaces, and it's a deterministic theory. Given an initial point, you can follow its trajectory. Now, if you have an ensemble of systems with the same initial wave function, it was shown in detail by Bohm in 1952 that you get quantum mechanics if you assume that the initial distribution of these points, in other words, so over an ensemble, we've got the same wave function for each system, but the initial configuration is different. If the distribution happens to be equal to psi squared, then you recover the same predictions as quantum mechanics. De Broglie actually showed some of this in 1927, but it wasn't shown fully until Bohm came in 1952. So let me just give an illustration for one particle. Just to get this clear, that you know, if I have the Schrödinger equation for one particle, it implies a continuity equation for psi squared. In this theory, psi is not a probability wave. I should have mentioned, psi in this theory is a physical wave. It exists in configuration space. It's a property of an individual system, and it affects the motion of a single system. It has no a priori connection with probability. The Schrödinger equation implies that the amplitude squared of this wave satisfies this equation. And you see here, this grad S over M is the same velocity field as appears in de Broglie's equation of motion. So if I have an ensemble of systems with different initial positions and the same wave function, the distribution of those positions, which could be arbitrary, maybe to say it could be anything would be a bit of an exaggeration, but anyway, an arbitrary distribution will necessarily obey this continuity equation. This just states that each particle is moving with this velocity. So now you have a simple theorem. You see that the general probability distribution obeys the same continuity equation as this psi squared. So if p and psi squared are initially equal, then they will remain equal at all times. Okay, that's a simple property of this theory, of that there's something called quantum equilibrium, the Born rule. If it's true initially, it remains true later on. So now let's look at the example of how this works for one particle, that if I have a wave function coming in and hitting a double slit, and that the Schrödinger wave evolves in the way it evolves, the particle will come in at some initial point and it will follow a wiggly pattern and land somewhere. If you repeat this many times with an ensemble of particles whose distribution is initially psi squared, then the distribution of points that land at the backstop will follow the usual psi squared interference pattern. Whereas if you have a different initial distribution, you will not get, in general, you won't get the usual interference pattern. So for example, an extreme case, an extreme non-equilibrium, all the initial points could be located close to this point, in which case all the particles will land around here and there will be no pattern out here at all. So this is an illustration of how on this model, the quantum theory is a special case of a wider physics. Now, something that needs to be explained though is that, well, all right, well, that's all very well, but why experimentally do we always see the psi squared distribution? So for example, if I have a particle in a two-dimensional box with a superposition of the first 16 energy states, if I prepare it in this state and I measure the distribution for an ensemble, I always find this. Why? So the de Broglie dynamics, de Broglie's theory, has an explanation, which is that, well, if I start out with a different distribution, so here time is running to the right. Here I have at the top, this is a plot of psi squared. This is just the Schrödinger wave function squared evolving in time for that 2D box state, okay? So this is just the Schrödinger evolution of psi squared. If I begin with an initial distribution that is not equal to psi squared, so here is a cos squared distribution in the box, and I follow the motion of each particle using de Broglie's law of motion, that mass times velocity is gradient of phase, you find that this distribution evolves, and on a coarse-grained level, it rapidly approaches the psi squared distribution. So this is a little bit like having molecules start out in the corner of a box and you let it evolve and they spread out and reach thermal equilibrium. Something comparable happens here. The actual trajectories in such a system, I have a super... Yeah?
If the Born distribution, if the wave function is time dependent and rapidly time dependent, is there a particular time that the non-equilibrium distribution catches up to the...
So crudely, it's comparable to the time scale over which the wave function evolves. Crudely.
But there are different ways... I'm starting off with different initial conditions. The way you've drawn it, it seems like after two time steps, it catches up.
So this is this is after one period. So clearly, for example, if this distribution was narrower, was further away from equilibrium, it would take longer.
I'm not questioning how long it takes, but at what point in the periodic evolution of the wave function does it match?
All right, so in this example, after just one period, it's already quite close.
Is there a shift in time that you need to match it? If I evolved backwards 5 seconds and then started with that initial configuration, it would evolve to the Born distribution, the psi squared, 5 seconds later.
Right.
So there's a possible time shift in getting it.
Oh, yeah, you're talking about time reversal.
I'm not yet talking about the universal, but that's coming.
Okay. Because maybe I can mention that there is fine-grained structure in this distribution. If you evolve, this is all time reversible, just like in classical statistical physics. If I replace psi by psi star, this will evolve backwards this way. So this kind of evolution, the kind of model approach I followed is analogous to the coarse-graining approach in classical statistical mechanics. If you assume that the initial distribution does not have structure on very fine-grained structure on small scales, then you know this, you expect to get this kind of evolution.
What sets the Poincaré time, or the equivalent of the Poincaré time?
You can, so that can also happen. There is an analog of the Poincaré recurrence theorem. But what will happen is that you know, an individual trajectory could recur after a certain number of cycles, but the chances of them all recurring at the same time is, you know, that's extremely unlikely.
Individual trajectory, but this is a continuum of...
So let me show you. So, for instance, I was just going to show you. Here's a picture of one trajectory beginning here, I think, at the midpoint and going around. They're quite erratic. And you know what we've got here. I mean, this is a numerical simulation, so you know, we take a lattice of a small, you know, of lots of trajectories and evolve them forward, and this is the kind of result.
How many particles is that?
So in these, the latest kinds of simulations we've been using several hundred thousand, few hundred thousand.
So, yeah, I guess that's my question. I mean, in principle, this could be a continuous distribution. Does that send the Poincaré time to infinity?
I don't think it's possible for the whole distribution to recur. Not in two or more dimensions. But maybe I'd have to just think about that. But I think that's right. I think what you've said is basically right. Yeah, I think that's right. That should be right. No, that should be right. Yeah. Okay. So let me say, okay, this has been, so something, I'll talk a bit more about this tomorrow. One can introduce something called, quantify this with a coarse-grained H function, which is basically minus the relative entropy of these two distributions. And then you find in a lot of these simulations, it decays approximately exponentially. But in this talk, let me just mention, you know, there are lots of other simulations. Here's a 2D oscillator with 25 modes. Here, time is going downward. So here's the initial psi squared, and is sloshing around. Here's an initial Gaussian, and, you know, and here's the kind of thing that happens. All right. So this was supposed to be the quick 15-minute background, and I've already used up at least half an hour. But anyway, this kind of picture that, look, you know, we're stuck in an equilibrium distribution. This is an instantiation of this general idea that you can start with a more general distribution and relax to what we see. Okay. Now,
this relaxation is global in a sense, because this is all non-local. I mean, the gradient.
Right. Yes. So in principle, you would be thinking about this in the early universe, which I'll be discussing a lot tomorrow in the colloquium. But in fact, it would have probably been a better idea if I'd given the colloquium first and then this talk, because there's sort of more background in the colloquium. But yes, in principle, I'm thinking about that this took place in the early universe. So what happened? A particle that, you know, that you... You know, I'm not thinking that, a particle that you get in the lab, I take out this electron, I put it in the box, I prepare it in a state, now it starts relaxing. No. This relaxation process would have taken place at the Big Bang, and things relaxed, you know, long eons ago.
Because it's in configuration space.
Right. Where you know, now you go in the lab, you pick out an electron or a hydrogen atom, it's been interacting with other things for millions of years, and it, you know, is already relaxed. So you're picking it out from an equilibrium ensemble, and of course you find the Born rule. Okay, but anyway, the main point for the purposes of this talk is the following, that in de Broglie's dynamics, quantum equilibrium is stable under even large perturbations away from quantum equilibrium. So here, you know, there's quite a big difference between this distribution and that distribution, but the dynamics brings you back as long as there's no fine-grained microstructure here. Anyway, but so with some assumptions, you can say that in this sense, in de Broglie's dynamics, quantum equilibrium is stable. So now what I'd like to talk about is Bohm's dynamics. Bohm, in 1952, proposed a similar but different version of de Broglie's theory. And let's consider this kind of question of relaxation. Is quantum equilibrium stable? I'm going to show you that actually in Bohm's dynamics is not stable. So what is Bohm's Newtonian version? Bohm essentially, if you take, let me maybe just go back. If you take de Broglie's equation of motion and you differentiate it with respect to time and you fiddle around a bit using the Schrödinger equation, you can derive an equation for the acceleration of the trajectory, which looks like this. It's minus the gradient of the classical potential plus something called the quantum potential, which is related to the amplitude of the wave function. Now, Bohm took this to be the law of motion. Now, in order to recover quantum mechanics from this, you need to assume two things about the initial conditions. First, you need to assume, as in de Broglie's dynamics, that the distribution of configurations is given by psi squared. And you have to assume that the initial momenta are given by the gradient of the potential at the initial time. Now, notice the difference that for Bohm, this is an initial condition, whereas for de Broglie, this is the law of motion. Okay, there's no question of, you know, this is just a law applied at all times. In Bohm's dynamics, this is something you apply at the initial time, and you can show that if this is true initially, then from the equation of motion, this is going to be true at all times. It's conserved by the equation of motion. Okay, so now, again, applying this reasoning that, well, initially there's a difference between laws and initial conditions. Just as in de Broglie's dynamics, I could consider a non-equilibrium, a probability not equal to psi squared. In Bohm's dynamics, I can consider initial momenta that are not equal to the gradient of the phase. So here's now a little sketch. There's quantum theory. There's the physics of quantum theory. I've said that de Broglie's dynamics is a wider physics that encompasses quantum theory that is broader because you can have quantum non-equilibrium. In Bohm's dynamics, there's an even wider physics that looks like this. So in quantum theory, you've got if P is equal to the gradient of S and P is psi squared, you're in equilibrium, you get quantum mechanics. De Broglie's dynamics, you've got this law of motion, but I can have arbitrary distributions that are not equal to psi squared, the quantum non-equilibrium that we've been discussing. There's an extended non-equilibrium, in Bohm's dynamics, in which the momenta are also not equal to the gradient of S. And the question is, so we've shown, as we've been discussing, if you start out here, then with some, you know, on some reasonable assumptions, you relax back into here. What happens if you start out here? Do you relax back? I'm going to show you that you don't. And I'm going to argue that for this reason, Bohm's dynamics is actually unphysical. So Bohm's dynamics, it allows extended non-equilibrium with non-standard momenta. I'm going to show that this extended non-equilibrium does not relax. And is not only is it not relaxed, it is in fact unstable. And that if Bohm's dynamics was true, we would not see quantum equilibrium today. Bohm's dynamics, in my view, is in gross conflict with experiment.
When you say relax, are you taking an absolutely general, for instance, distribution?
Okay. So here is the... So as in classical statistical mechanics, it's a time reversal invariant theory. So it's impossible to prove that any distribution approaches an equilibrium. There's always a time reversal. So what you have to do is you have to put some restriction, what you regard as some reasonable restriction on your initial state. So there are different ways of doing this. So one way is to say that, well, you know, if we look at small coarse graining cells, let's assume that the coarse grained and fine grained values are equal. So there's no fine grained microstructure. And then, you know, structure can develop in the cells and you approach equilibrium. But when the system approaches equilibrium, fine grained structure does develop in the cells, violating this initial condition. So, you know, if I took the final state and I say, let's do a time reversal, let's take that as my initial state and evolve backwards. Well, this initial state has fine grained microstructure, so it's not the kind of initial state that we'll consider. This kind of thing, I mean, other people do it differently. Other people say initial state, there has to be no correlations between the initial molecules or whatever in a gas, this kind of thing. You always have to put some restriction on the initial state in order to demonstrate this in any time reversal invariant theory. So these kinds of questions, they're there in classical statistical mechanics and they're here too. So when I say, you know, relax with some reasonable assumptions, that's a kind of coded, you know, 3-second summary of a long discussion about the foundations of statistical mechanics, which there are those issues there. Okay, so now let me go. All right, so now, so Bohm's dynamics. Here we are. This is Bohm's dynamics. We're going to consider relaxing this distribution, but now Bohm's dynamics is in phase space. Okay, you've got a position of momentum in phase space. It is more like a classical system with this extra quantum potential. In order to get quantum theory, the equilibrium distribution looks like this in phase space. It's mod psi squared times a delta function. The momentum is restricted to be on a certain surface. P has to equal the gradient of the phase. So now what I'm saying is that the Bohm's dynamics allows you to consider an arbitrary distribution in phase space, which of course will obey, is just a continuity equation in phase space. The phase space velocity field is given by this. X dot is just P over M, and P dot, this is Bohm's law of motion with this quantum potential. And the question is, well, if I start out with a non-equilibrium distribution, will it relax? Now, there's some interesting things. So Bohm's dynamics is just Newton's dynamics with an additional time-dependent potential. Because it's time-dependent, the energy is not conserved. In Bohm's dynamics, the quantum potential, in effect, acts like an external energy source. So there's no fixed energy surface in phase space. But you still have Liouville's theorem, of course. So the actual value of the density is preserved along a trajectory in phase space.
Where is the time dependence? Is it del squared, square root of rho, or square?
So Q, so psi, the modulus of psi in general depends on time?
Well, everything depends on time, but that's not the same thing as being explicitly time dependent.
So Q is a function of position and of time.
What you're saying is...
What I'm saying is it has a
conservation law for kinetic energy plus V plus Q.
So if I define the total energy to be the kinetic energy plus V plus Q, the time derivative of that is not zero. It will equal the partial derivative of Q with respect to T. Okay, the partial derivative of Q with respect to T is not zero. So that's what I mean. So you still have Liouville's theorem, of course. But now there's something interesting. Because of Liouville's theorem, Bohm's dynamics, there are actually two equilibrium distributions. One is just your usual, if there's some available region of phase space, if the initial density is constant in the available region, well, those values are preserved along the trajectories. This is an equilibrium distribution. But there is also the quantum equilibrium distribution. There's an odd dynamical system. There are two equilibrium distributions. And you might wonder, well, is it going to relax to one or the other? But the fact that there are two equilibrium distributions, will it confuse the system? There's an old argument, debate I've had with people about using typicality to justify equilibrium. But there's a question about, well, with respect to what measure would you define typicality, and so on and so on. But let's get on. Okay, I've already said this, that this is not going to relax, that it's going to be unstable, and that if Bohm's dynamics was true, we would not see equilibrium today. In fact, I'm going to show you that there will be no bound states, there will be no atoms and so on, and that even in the vacuum, vacuum fields would be arbitrarily large if Bohm's theory was true. So let's look at the instability of Bohm's dynamics. So first of all, simple example, just to get us started. Let's look at the ground state of a bound system. Hydrogen atom, simple harmonic oscillator. The phase of the wave function just depends on time. Its gradient is zero. So in de Broglie's dynamics, let's first think about this in de Broglie's dynamics. The momentum, or the velocity, is predicted to vanish. So in the ground state of the hydrogen atom, the electron is just sitting there. It's not moving. So now let's consider an initial deviation from equilibrium in de Broglie's dynamics. So for instance, imagine that this blue is psi squared, and imagine that all the particles are concentrated in this region. I mean, it's actually quite a big deviation from equilibrium. But anyway, let's imagine that this is P and this blue is psi squared. Well, it's static. The system would just sit there. Nothing would happen. So this deviation would just stay there. All right, it wouldn't evolve. Whereas if the atom was in a superposition of states, if it was in a superposition of energy states, then by the kind of simulations I've shown you, this would relax, subject to the caveats that we've briefly mentioned. All right, now let's look at the same example in Bohm's dynamics. In the ground state of the atom, now the acceleration is zero as well. I mean, it's the same trajectory. So the gradient of the velocity minus the gradient of the quantum potential is zero. The acceleration is predicted to be zero. So now let's consider, as we can in Bohm's dynamics, a deviation of P from the gradient of S. Well, the gradient of S is zero. So what we're saying is, here's our system. Everything's static. Everything's at rest. Nothing's moving. Nothing's accelerating. But let's now take the initial velocity actually to be a bit different from zero. Well, the acceleration is zero, so that velocity will just stay constant. This thing will just leave the system. Okay, it will just leave the system. And with respect to position space, the non-equilibrium will grow. It will get further and further away from equilibrium. Now, you might think, well, maybe that's just a problem with a ground state, yes?
Yeah, no, I'm not following. It's a computation that the gradient of Q of del squared square root of rho over square root of rho,
yes,
is zero for a ground state.
That's right. No, that's right. It's in fact, if you look, it's quite easy to see from the Schrödinger equation that if the wave function is real, and you can replace it by its modulus, then if you look at the Schrödinger equation for an energy eigenstate, and you divide both sides by mod psi, you get that V plus Q is equal to the energy eigenvalue. And so the gradient is zero because the energy eigenvalue is just a constant. Maybe we'll talk about it after. But anyway, this is true. The acceleration or the ground state of harmonic oscillator, the acceleration is predicted to be zero. So anyway, so you get this kind of phenomenon that this bound state becomes unbound. Now you might think, well, okay, but what if we run it for superpositions? Maybe then, you know, and that's more realistic because in the early universe things have been violent interacting. Maybe then things will relax and everything's okay. Maybe it's just a problem for an energy eigenstate. Well, actually, no. Even for superpositions, you do not get relaxation. Let me show you some numerical and analytical evidence for this. So here's a harmonic oscillator. Here the state is, I've got the first three energy eigenstates superposed. And at t is zero, this green curve is a plot. The curve P is grad S. So sorry, this is a plot in phase space. Here is X along the x-axis and P along the y-axis. So I've got x and p. And the green curve is a plot of P of the equation P equals grad S at the initial time. And we start out with a little ensemble of particles whose momenta are close to that, that surface. And then we evolve it forwards in time. In our units, at t is 5, the curve P is grad S is now this magenta curve. And you see that there's been something like a sort of partial relaxation, that things have spread out a bit on this curve. So it started looking like, well, hang on, if I start, you know, almost on the surface, I spread out on the surface. And you might think, ah, okay, so things will relax. But let's now look at the same example, but where I begin just slightly off the surface. Okay, my momenta are slightly different now from grad S. And then that's, so the green curve and the red, this is at T is 0. At T is 5, this is P is grad S, and the particles now are actually moving off. And in fact, for greater than x greater than 3, they look as if they're starting to leave the system. So for this example, you can actually show, I'll talk more about this in a couple of slides, that the acceleration here, if you look at the acceleration field, it's bounded below by minus a constant over x squared. And minus a constant over x squared is like a Newtonian gravitational force. So you get the same phenomenon of escape velocity. If the velocity is above a certain value, it will actually leave the system. And this is what is happening here. If you're far enough out here, you actually start to leave the system. Done some similar things for the hydrogen atom. Here's a superposition of three energy states. What we've got here is some trajectories. There's one trajectory where we just begin with the de Broglie momentum. P is grad S. Okay, I've got a hydrogen atom, a superposition of three energy states. What happens to the de Broglie trajectory? Well, it is just moving around. It's just moving around in there, okay? If you start out with a momentum that's slightly different from grad S, then, you know, it does this. It's starting to move out a bit. You start with a slightly bigger difference between P and grad S, and this is what you get. If the difference is bigger still, it flies out and leaves the system. So there you go. We actually have an analytical result for the harmonic oscillators. So this is work, I should have mentioned, work I did with Samuel Collin, who was a postdoc with me at Clemson. So if you have an arbitrary superposition of energy states with a bounded spectrum, you can calculate the acceleration field. This clicker is not. This acceleration field, you can show that it's bounded below by minus b over x squared for some constant b that depends on the state for sufficiently large x. So what that means is, if I've got an arbitrary superposition of state, I mean, here's my oscillator, it's an arbitrary superposition of energy states. If I'm sort of sufficiently far away from the bulk, here, the de Broglie momentum actually goes to zero. The gradient of S gets very small. But if the actual initial momentum is slightly bigger than that value, and when I say slightly bigger, as quantified by this formula here, then it will escape. So if you're out in the, if you're sufficiently far out in the tail, all the particles here are just going to, if the de Broglie momenta is a bit bigger than what is, sorry, if the Bohm momentum is a bit bigger than the de Broglie momentum, it will just leave the system. So the claim is that we have evidence that in Bohm's dynamics, there's no tendency to relax to equilibrium. The equilibrium state is, in fact, unstable. I start out, you know, with respect to position, the non-equilibrium is actually growing. The bulk of the positions are getting further and further away from the psi squared distribution. And the claim is that, well, then, now I want to connect it with what we see with experiment and say that, look, if Bohm's dynamics were true, there would be no bound states today and vacuum fields would be arbitrarily large. Why would there be no bound states today? You might say, hang on a second, why no bound states today? It might be, perhaps the universe reached equilibrium way back and close to the beginning, long before atoms form. So, you know, atoms don't form until after recombination about 400,000 years after the Big Bang. So if equilibrium was already reached, this is all irrelevant, atoms would form, you're talking nonsense. Okay, well, actually, if I look at a field theoretical description of the early universe, you find the same instability. So let's look, for example, at a decoupled scalar field mode on expanding space. And I'll be looking at this in a lot of detail tomorrow in the colloquium. But if you look at the Fourier component, here I'm looking at a massless scalar field on expanding space. A is the scale factor. I'm looking at one Fourier component of the field, and I look at its real and imaginary parts. The Schrödinger equation, if that mode is not entangled with the rest of the degrees of freedom, the Schrödinger equation is just like the equation for a two-dimensional harmonic oscillator with a time-dependent mass and a time-dependent angular frequency. If the wavelength of the mode is small compared to the Hubble radius, then I can treat this A as essentially constant. In other words, I'm talking about the Minkowski limit of a scalar field expanding background. So in the early universe, at short wavelengths, what do I get? I get equations where these A's are now constants. This is mathematically exactly the same as a two-dimensional low-energy harmonic oscillator. So I get exactly the same kind of instability. If the initial velocities of these degrees of freedom are different from this on the right-hand side, this is what de Broglie's law of motion would tell you it has to be. If they were different, then you're going to get the same thing, that the values of these components, these Qs, are going to grow with time. And so the actual value of the scalar field will grow unboundedly. So you would expect to see, you know, if the early universe started out of equilibrium in Bohm's dynamics, today you would expect to see arbitrarily large field strengths. You apply this to the electromagnetic field, you expect to see arbitrarily large field strengths on average, even in the vacuum. So, all right, so what's the conclusion? I think another 5 minutes, I should be finished. So Bohm's dynamics agrees with quantum theory only if we assume these special initial conditions, that you have to have rho is psi squared and the momenta concentrated on this surface in phase space. If Bohm's dynamics is correct, we should not expect to see an effective quantum theory today in contradiction with observation. Conclusion. I think the conclusion here is that I think Bohm's dynamics, the difference between Bohm's and de Broglie's dynamics has been for decades just been a matter of taste, a matter of theoretical expediency, preferences. I think actually Bohm's pseudo-Newtonian reformulation was a mistake. It's not a viable candidate for physical theory. And the de Broglie's original formulation, it's a velocity-based dynamics, was actually correct. And of course, whether it's true or not is another matter, but it remains a viable candidate for physical theory. So if I can just make some final remarks, just in another minute or two, and just talk a bit about, I think I'd like to advocate that generally speaking, I'm more interested in hidden variables theories generally than I am in de Broglie and Bohm in particular, even though I find these two models very instructive to work with. But you know, they might be wrong, but I still incline to think that the general hidden variable picture is correct. And something that I've emphasized for a long time is that, look, if you're going to interpret a deterministic hidden variables theory correctly, you have to consider quantum non-equilibrium in order to see the true physics of the theory. The physics of these theories is hidden mostly, largely, if you're in equilibrium. It appears effectively local. It appears effectively non-contextual, all this stuff. They're illusions in the sense that they are properties of a particular state. They're not properties of the fundamental physics. So you have to look non-equilibrium in order to understand what the theory really looks like. Been saying that for a long time. Something I'd like to add, okay, so this sort of idea, you know, the conspiracy theory, you need to, in order to understand what the theory is really saying, you have to consider what's out here, okay? But now I'd like to add that something else, that to account convincingly for what we see, the theory should be stable under at least small perturbations away from equilibrium. Otherwise, you replace one conspiracy with another. If you say, look, I can explain what we see, but the initial conditions of the parameter have to be exactly on this particular surface, otherwise everything is wrecked. Well, then it looks to me as if, of course, some people will say, well, look, it's a logical possibility. I can just postulate that. But then you're getting into this, I think you're blurring the distinction between laws of physics and initial conditions. If you think that you know, the laws of physics are supposed to be, you know, they're things that you don't tweak. They're there, they're fixed, they're eternal, or maybe they're not, as Lee might argue. But anyway, let's say the standard point of view, you've got these eternal Platonic laws and initial conditions, that they're something that they're malleable. There's a contingency. You could think of them as being perhaps a bit different. If you think of them as having been slightly different, then destroys all of your conclusions. Well, I would say there's something wrong with your model. So I'd like to advocate stability in this sense as a criterion for hidden variables theories generally. De Broglie's 1927 dynamics passes this test. Bohm's 1952 dynamics does not. So, and that's it. Thank you.
So yes. Is there a general argument that could reach the same conclusion but focuses on the following difference between psi squared and grad s, that in the one case...
Sorry, the difference between...
Between the one kind of relaxation...
Ah, but the psi squared and the grad s.
Versus
right.
The momentum p right. to grad s. So in the case of p going to psi squared, in fact, you're only getting it approximating psi squared on a coarse grain sense.
Coarse grain level,
and
yeah.
So you have consistency with time reversal because you have this fine grain structure. Mm-hmm. And so you have a notion of what it means to relax that isn't in conflict with time symmetry argument. But can we even formulate a notion of what it would mean for the momenta to relax to grad s and still be time symmetric? Because it couldn't relax exactly, you know, otherwise, you know, I would be in conflict with time symmetry.
Fair enough, okay.
So it was the idea that there would be some way to sort of approximate grad s, but there's some sort of fine structure in the momentum field that would be different from grad s.
Okay. So something that maybe I can go back. When we first started looking at this, you know, we weren't sure what would happen, you know, before we started doing these numerical simulations, because, you know, as I said here, that, you know, it's a very unusual dynamical system. You've got these two different equilibrium states. We really weren't sure what on earth was going to happen. Now, this was one of the first simulations we did, if I remember rightly, and you see it looks as if it's starting to relax. So this is just two-dimensional phase space. Here's the initial surface. The green line is P is grad S initially. The magenta line, this line here is P is grad S at the later time. What could have happened, for all we knew, is that let's say I start out, maybe I start out like this. Let's say we start out with a distribution that's off the surface, okay? What could have happened, for all we knew, is this distribution, it could have spread out, it could have become very thin, and it could have spread out on over this line, as sort of happens to an extent here. Okay, it could. In other words, what I'm saying is the volume of this thing in phase space, the total phase space volume is conserved from Liouville's theorem. But the equilibrium surface is a zero volume. It's a surface in phase space. So that density, it could have spread out very thinly over that surface, for all we knew, and still being consistent with Liouville's theorem. And perhaps it would have had lots of fine grained structure. It could have spread out and been, you know. And in fact, this was the thought initially that maybe this would happen. It would spread over the energy surface, and it would be, I guess, I mean, we didn't really think about fine-grained structure on the surface, but what you might think about is that the there will be fine-grained structure in this sense, is in that it would never reach exactly, it would never be exactly spread just on the surface. There would always be maybe some small thickness. There would always be some very large distances that it hadn't reached, possibly. Because, you know, I've got a finite volume that I'm trying to spread, you know, on a surface. So I'm trying to paint this surface, if you like, with a finite amount of paint. So that could have happened. It could be that, well, at a very large time, it spreads very thinly over the energy surface, but it's not perfect, but it's close to equilibrium. And of course, if you time reverse, then you get back to where you were. So, you know, short answer is yes. I think actually you could have an analogy, but it would have to look something like this. And as I said, it turns out that actually, but that's not what happened. You're off the surface. Instead of it spreading over the surface, it actually, it starts to move off and escapes.
So one reason why some people like the Bohm version over the de Broglie version, which we discussed years ago, is that the de Broglie version looks not relativistically invariant. It looks like you're in a frame of reference, because you have a law of nature prescribing what the velocity should be.
Yes. Good. Good. So yes, so interesting. So, you know, one man's meat is another man's poison. I mean, because that to me is actually another reason why I prefer de Broglie's dynamics, because to my mind, while the theory is fundamentally non-local, you expect there to be a preferred foliation of space-time, a preferred time parameter,
and a preferred rest frame.
And in a theory that is, in a velocity-based theory, I mean, I've written a paper about this a long time ago, about if I have a law of motion that says mass times velocity equals something, if you think about, you know, how do you define what kinematics is? How do you define a natural state of rest? So in Newton's law, you've got mass times acceleration equals force. And the natural state of motion is when the force is zero. In other words, the acceleration is zero. And so natural states of motion are uniform velocity, you know, uniform motion in a straight line. And the kind of natural kinematics that you have is what we're used to, where velocity is relative. In de Broglie's dynamics, I've argued that the natural kinematics of the theory is actually Aristotelian. If the law of motion is that mass times velocity equals something, then the unforced or natural states of motion have mass times velocity is zero. In other words, the thing is at rest. And the natural kinematics of the theory is actually one order lower than, instead of getting, you know, Galilean or relativistic space-time, you get space-time with a natural preferred state of rest. So I see that as actually a strength. In fact, another criticism I would have, you know, turning it around of Bohm's dynamics, is in Bohm's dynamics, the natural kinematics, if say you look at the low energy version, the natural kinematics is Galilean space-time. But then there's a problem, because, well, then you expect that if you go to a relativistic extension, the natural kinematics will be Minkowski space-time. But then how is that going to work with non-locality? If you don't have a preferred frame, then you know the possibility of inconsistencies and so on. So. Yes. Raphael, hello. Hello there, how are you?
What were your two, in the cosmological case, you looked at an oscillator, a particular mode, and you had two oscillators there. Just what was the relation of those two oscillators?
So what that was, is I have, so let's say you have a massless scalar field on expanding space.
Yeah.
And I look at it in Fourier space. So here is, I look at the Fourier components of the
right.
scalar field.
Right. Yeah.
And let's imagine that the wave functional for the whole field is, you could think of it as a product over all the modes, or at least, or let's say the total wave functional is equal to a wave function for this one mode multiplied by all the rest that are entangled. So in other words, you've got one mode that's unentangled. Okay, so I can consider the wave function for that one mode, which is a function of these two real degrees of freedom. And the...
Is just like the real and imaginary...
These are just the real and imaginary parts. Oh, yeah, sorry, there's just the real and imaginary parts of the Fourier component.
I see, okay.
So the Schrödinger equation, it looks just like a two-dimensional oscillator, and you know, so that was the argument. Yeah.
And this was especially flat.
I was actually thinking of a flat expanding space. Yeah, flat expanding space. And as I said, in the short wavelength limit, you can think of these the scale factor is constant, and you just recover the equations for a 2D oscillator with mass m is a cubed, and then you get exactly the same thing, that you get the same instability. If the initial velocities are different from the de Broglie value, then these q's are going to grow, and so the Fourier component is just going to grow with time and become unbounded in magnitude, and it's a disaster.
Okay, in connection with gravity, I wanted to mention an analogy. I don't know what its analogy to exactly, but it resembles, it's just a thought, so I...
Sure, oh, please.
If you want. I mean, in the case of gravity, if people try to solve it in a 3+1 way, you know, numerically.
Yes.
And one of the things is the constraints, the gravity, the constraint equations, right? And they have actually some sort of similarity to your constraint of putting the particle on the B equals grad
right.
S surface.
Yes. Yes.
I think generically they're also unstable.
Are they? They're generically unstable?
This is linearization stability.
No, it's not. Well, I don't know if it's related to that necessarily. No, that's a more subtle thing. I'd have to think about it. I'm not aware of any connection with that. And then people use numerical techniques. In that case, they do just enforce the constraints, right? They just say, this is part of our laws,
yeah.
So we can use numerical techniques like artificial viscosity or something
right.
to keep the solution on the constraint. So in that case, no one is actually unhappy.
Right, so
now you may, I
understand.
I'm sure there's a difference, but...
Right, so the difference would be, is that I guess I've understood what you're saying. If I take, can people see, is this?
No.
This is weird chalk. If I take the Einstein equations, and I will say that G00.
I'm just gonna turn off
the lights. Okay, it's an
I think it should make it worse. You really want that. Yeah.
It's an interesting parallel, but I guess the difference is if I take the Einstein equations and I look at the time-time and the time-space component, and I look at the space-space component, so these are, you know, second order in the GIJs, whereas these are all first order.
It's exactly. Those are the constraints.
Is that right? Yeah.
In momentum space, the G0i become.
But what I wanted to say is that, I mean, I think what you're talking about is, so I can think of these as constraints at the initial time on some initial surface that I have to impose, and then these are actually, these equations evolve the constraints, okay? I can think of these as the dynamical part, and these are just initial conditions, and there's a similar issue with Maxwell's equations. Now, the difference is that my argument is that in Bohm's dynamics, if the fundamental law of motion is mass times acceleration is force, the initial momentum, just like the initial position, is arbitrary. It could be, I'm going to say anything, but anyway, it is arbitrary. It doesn't have to be any particular value. Whereas here, the difference is that we do think of this as a law. And, you know, all of these, even though mathematically, you know, you would say, well, it's convenient to consider these as initial conditions and then evolve them according to this, nobody thinks that, well, I can just as well consider these non-zero. I mean, that would violate the laws of gravity. It would violate Einstein's equations. So these still have a law-like character in classical gravity. Now, actually, it's an interesting thought. Maybe they shouldn't. Maybe one could consider the...
Come to a kind of breaking of...
Could it be...
...quantum invariance, like of Bohm-De Bois theory would lead you to. Yeah, it's just a
sign. Anyway, no, but it's something one, you know, one might consider, well, what happens if I take these different from zero, and do they relax, do they, if this is the dynamic. But the standard view is that all of these equations are laws, and that, you know, to change them would violate the laws of physics. Whereas in the Bohm, if I've got this, say, just for one particle, if I've got this, it's a second order equation of motion, so this is the law. And the initial conditions are the initial position and the initial velocity. Now, this does not have to, does it have to equal 1 over m grad s? Well, it doesn't have to. It could, it might do.
So I think in the case of the Einstein equations, there's an extra factor, which is that these two equations, G00 and G0i, they also generate the dynamics themselves. I mean, Gij is kind of a gradient in phase space of those equations. And the difficult there is if you choose a different one, if you try to choose different G00, for example, you don't get it to be conserved through its own dynamics.
Right. So when you say, I mean, it's often said that these generate the dynamics. I mean, I think maybe what you mean is that if I impose these conditions on arbitrary surfaces at a point, then it's equivalent to the full set of Einstein equations. Is that what you mean? Because basically, so in that sense, but if I'm just considering one particular foliation, then, you know, one can say, well, with respect to that particular foliation, there's a distinction between the constraints on the initial surface and the evolution equation. But as I say, you know, these are all regarded, normally they're all regarded as fixed laws, whereas here, I mean, Bohm, I should mention that Bohm in 1952, it's interesting that he was very clear in his paper, he stated explicitly that so in order to get quantum theory, I need P is psi squared, and I need P is grad S. And he states very clearly that, look, these are assumed initial conditions that are not, with regard to this, the sentence he uses, he says something like, this is not inherent in the conceptual structure. Okay, this is the conceptual structure. It's, you know, it's a force law, a Newtonian law with an extra potential. This is, and he did consider briefly what would happen if P was not equal to grad S, and what he actually proposed was modifying the Schrödinger equation in such a way that there will be an extra force that pulls P back towards grad S. In other words, he wanted to, I think the effect of his modification was that there will be an extra term here that looked something qualitatively, something like this, a function of P minus grad S. And he wanted this to be zero when P is grad S, and he wanted to have it the right sign so that if you had deviations, it would pull it back. But, you know, there was a kind of possible extension of the theory. But the actual model he discussed, Bohm was quite clear that this is the law and these are initial conditions. Unfortunately, this distinction got lost in later presentations, not only by others, but even by Bohm himself. If you look at, for instance, the book by Bohm and Hiley, or you know, many books, you see all of these conditions presented almost as if they're axioms, even this one. P is psi squared. I've been arguing about this with people for decades. That they seem to think that the fundamental laws of this are the laws of motion plus this, you know, whatever, and that gives you quantum mechanics. And I've been arguing that, look, no, there's a difference between the law of motion and the initial conditions. These are initial conditions which could have been different. Anyway, so I'm going off on a tangent. Someone better stop.
Okay. Giotto and Girardi showed that if you just want to reproduce the operational predictions, there are other choices of guidance equation that also work. So if I take the velocity to be grad s over m plus any divergenceless current density field over psi squared,
sure,
I will find that if the initial distribution is psi squared, it continues to be psi squared over time. So it seemed to me that, I mean, what Bohm could have said is, I don't need that as initial condition, P equal to grad S. I need P equal to grad S plus some divergenceless current density over psi squared. As long as I have that, I'll get all the predictions of usual quantum mechanics. So for your project, it seems to me that, you know, supposing that a deviation from P is equal to psi squared relaxed to P equal to grad S, relax to P is equal to grad S plus this divergenceless current density over psi squared, that would be fine for getting back to equilibrium. So it seems to me it's not enough to show that you're no longer satisfying the P equal to grad S condition. You need to show that you're not satisfying any of this infinite family of conditions that reproduces the same operational predictions.
I see. So you're saying that there might be an alternative model in which the Brolyan velocity law is P is grad S plus something, but which is still consistent with the empirical predictions, and that may be in such a model. But hang on, so no, I don't get this. If we're still, are you saying that if we then considered arbitrary initial momenta, that perhaps they would relax back to that momentum law? Did I misunderstand what you're saying? Because I can't see how that could happen, because if this is still my basic law, we didn't look for it, but it didn't look as if the momenta were relaxing to anything in particular, but from
what you showed, it seemed to me that this way out is implausible. So what I'm saying is that one should formulate the problem as follows. It would have sufficed to take the initiative to get the empirical predictions of quantum theory. Bohm did not need to assume that P is equal to grad S. All he needed to assume was that P is equal to one of an infinite family of possibilities. Grad S plus divergenceless current density over psi squared for any current density field that's divergenceless. Okay, so that's the new picture. Any of these guys will agree with our predictions. Now let's imagine deviations from that. And now the point is that if you deviate from any of those conditions, all you need to do is relax to one of them to get back to
I see.
And it's not enough to say, it didn't relax to momentum equal to grad S. You have to show it didn't relax to any of the infinite family to show that it doesn't reproduce those predictions.
Okay, that's interesting. So I think, let me just think here. I mean, one problem here, Rob, because we didn't really look particularly at the momentum distributions. What we were taking as a signal for things going badly wrong is that with respect to positions, the systems become unbound. So, even if it was the case that, the actual momenta taking on values that are equal to grad S plus something else that is still, with respect to position space, the distribution in positions is getting further and further away from psi squared, the bound state. I mean, this equation just by itself tells you that, if I'm in a, if I've got the small perturbations from the usual momenta, give you trajectories that leave the system, becomes unbound. I don't see how that could change. So you would still have non-equilibrium with respect to position.
So maybe I agree that it looks implausible what I'm saying, but what it means for your presentation is that rather than saying the momentum does not go to grad S, let's look at where it should be, it's not there, maybe you should start with the original non-equilibrium and say, now let's ask whether P goes over to psi squared, like P, the probability.
That's a fair point.
If it becomes further and further away, then you could say, we're not going to have relaxation in the position sector.
That's a fair point. I mean, it's a fair point. There is a class of, for those who may be not sure what we're talking about is that you've got this, if I've just got one particle, got this continuity equation, and de Broglie takes this to be the velocity, but I could add a term that is, I could replace this by psi squared grad S over m plus some vector field that's divergence free.
Does that relate to a gauge invariance?
Well, here you would actually have different trajectories. You would be saying that the new velocity field would be grader S over M plus W over psi squared. And so I can always add a divergence-free velocity field divided by psi squared to the de Broglie velocity and reproduce the same conservation of psi squared. I have a different set of trajectories. Of course, if you are out of equilibrium, then you would notice the difference. You would have the evolution of psi squared is not affected by such a change, but the evolution of an arbitrary distribution would be affected. So it's again one of these things where in equilibrium you get a kind of smearing and a masking of what's really going on. It's a fair point. So that's a fair point. That's a good thing.
One remark about in your stories, there's really two momenta. There's, let's say, the kinematical momenta, P, which is mx dot. And then there's the canonical momenta, which is the guy conjugated to the position, which is d phi. And even, Bohm case is the case where you align these two momenta. Now, what's interesting is that, at least in the relativistic context, we have a physical interpretation of when these two momenta are not aligned with each other. So here you were looking at the dynamics of the difference between the canonical momenta and the kinematical momenta. And this difference, for instance, is how, in a relativistic setting, you encode the electromagnetic field. So first of all, the electromagnetic field can be determined as the this difference, which is independent of the velocity, and the gravitational field is exactly the difference which depends on the velocity. So it turns out that in the extension of the theories we have, which includes gauge theories, electromagnetic and gravity, we do have laws that governs the evolution of these differences.
Right. So,
You're not there, but. So it might be interesting, there are many cases. So turning on, you see what I'm saying, turning on gravity or gauge.
So for instance, if you had a vector potential,
exactly,
then you're gonna get this sort of thing, or is it minus, always get the sign wrong, but anyway.
So let's call it big P, the canonical momenta.
P is grad S plus QA. If I have,
exactly.
Probably got the sign wrong, but I've never been able to remember
the
sign.
So then we have an equation that governs
okay.
A.
So you would have, if for instance you had, let's say you had a single particle in an external electromagnetic field, then the guidance equation, the de Broglie guidance equation, would look like this. It would say mass, sorry, I'm using P to mean kinetic momentum or whatever you want to call it. The de Broglie guidance equation would say that mass times velocity is equal to grad S plus a contribution
just
from the vector potential.
Just when you invoke it, the light goes away.
The generalization will be in Bohm's model, this would be an initial condition. So the kind of thing I've been talking about, we would be looking at initial conditions where this is true and asking, do these momenta, do they relax back to this value?
Yeah, but A has its own dynamics, right?
Oh, yeah, so, okay, so A, so A could
the
have...
thing is that in the realm of, if you take A as being non-dynamical, there's a Bohmian version, but now what's interesting is that in physics, the gauge field, this difference between canonical is part of the dynamics, that's what the gauge fields are.
Well, sure. I mean,
so you have, this.
So you could, here I'm talking about, a low energy charged particle with an interacting with an external field. If you want to look at something like field theory, let's say you have, a charge scalar field interacting with the electromagnetic field.
The low energy charged particle are going to steer the.
So I'm not sure how this is really going to change anything. You now have two sets of fields. You've got your charge scalar field, you've got the electromagnetic field, and they each have their guidance equations.
It's not a change. I'm just saying that there is an opening that, let's say, if the two are not aligned, you're saying it's dramatically wrong, but there's another option that maybe there's a way in which they're not aligned, which is interesting.
Oh, I see.
Gravity,
oh, I see. Oh, I see. I see.
exactly what it is about.
I see. You're saying that maybe there's a way.
This is where you're saying that maybe there's a way
of thinking about the Bohm dynamics with P not equal to grad S that is in some way with some kind of extension. That's an interesting thought.
To say it precisely, perhaps the consistency condition that you're looking for is the Maxwell equation.
So
I tell you why I don't think, you know, if I have, say, let's say I have a charge scalar field, and the electromagnetic field interacting, okay, and I have my usual, gauge symmetry, minus I, F, etc., A, and again, I always get the sign wrong, is it minus grad F, whatever, okay? If I have this kind of thing, so I have a charged scalar field interacting with the electromagnetic field, the way you would describe it in de Broglie-Bohm is I have a wave functional.
Yeah, no, that's not what I want. Let's stay with particles.
And you,
what I'm saying is that you could try to get the dynamics of QD from the laws of deviation. That's something else.
But let me just finish. You see, what you're going to have here is that the de Broglie equation of motion for for the fields looks like this, where I've written psi as mod psi e to the is. These are functional derivatives. So what you would have is the, Bohm would be saying, well, let's start off with initial velocities that are different. And the Bohm equation of motion, he has, so the analog of Bohm's law, Newton's law, is having, let's say you've got the Klein-Gordon field. Let's say you've got the Klein-Gordon equation, but where there's a correction from the quantum potential. There's a quantum potential term that's analogous to that. I think all the same thing is going to happen.
What I'm saying is that you have an equation that computes the deviation of the canonical momentum
for
the particle. Let's say with the particle. You have an equation that computes the deviation. Then, it would be a total coincidence. But there's still a question. Maybe that deviation is exactly the deviation that follows the Coulombic creation of a Coulombic field by a bunch of charged particle. I mean, what I'm saying is that there may be a rationale to that deviation, which in fact is related to electromagnetism. That's an option.
Something to think about anyway.
Right? Okay. Just in the context of particle. And maybe not, or at least it would be interesting to us what kind of
something to think about. Maybe there's a way of saving Bohm's dynamics
by interpreting physically the difference.
Okay. Thank you.
Maybe we can continue the discussion. Let's thank Anthony again.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Thank you.